to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast. I'm over in Ireland this week visiting my father and I don't have my recording equipment, which was something I forgot about. So I'm recording this intro straight into my laptop, which I hope comes out okay. This interview this week is with Alejandro Macedo, a Venezuelan national part-time journalist and computer programmer who I started talking to on Twitter a few months, well, I think it was about 8 weeks ago. It was around the launch of the Petro, because being a Venezuelan national and a part-time journalist, he was writing about this, and I'd read one of his articles, I reached out to him, and we had a bit of a chat, and for a while we've been trying to organise a time to get together, because he also works in the crypto world, and I thought it would be a really interesting interview to have on the podcast. So with Bitcoin and crypto, there is a lot of money being made on speculation, but people are always countering that by saying, well, there aren't any real use cases, but actually in Venezuela, there is. People are using Bitcoin to counter the effects of hyperinflation. So I thought this would be a really useful interview to understand what is happening in the country and the use cases for Bitcoin there. Sadly, there are some issues with the sound here, which has happened on a few of my previous podcasts, but I think I found the gremlin in the works. It turns out I've got a faulty microphone. So it's a little bit frustrating because there is crackling through the interview. But if you can bear with it, it's really worth listening to because I think this is a really important interview to help us understand what the potential is for Bitcoin in a number of countries. We do focus on the recent history of Venezuela. I did a lot of research, read a lot about the background to Hugo Chavez and his successor, Nicolas Maduro, trying to understand the socialist policies they put in place and why they failed. So we cover that at the start to set the scene for the interview. And then we start talking about crypto and Bitcoin and mining and how that's being used in Venezuela. My engineer, Jason, has done his best to try and deal with the sound. But yeah, I hope you can bear with it because I think this is a really useful interview and it's one I really enjoy doing as well. Please support the show. I always ask this every week, and I will ask it again. 5-star reviews go a long way. Those of you who email me or message me to say you've done one, I'm very, very grateful. So thank you so much for doing that. Also, follow me on social media. I'm on Medium, Reddit, Steemit. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook. I'm on everything. You can find me just by searching for at What Bitcoin Did. And if you reach out to me, I will probably reply back to you as long as you're not asking me what the top 5 crypto investments are, because I've got no idea. You can use my website. My website's at www.whatbitcoindid.com. You can sign up to my email newsletters. You can use my training course, lots of useful stuff there, and you can share this out with your friends on social media. Okay, listen, I hope you enjoy the show. I hope you enjoy everything Alejandro has to say. I was really grateful for him to come into London to do this interview. If you have any questions, do reach out to me. You can do that on Twitter or you can email me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com and I will probably reply to you if you get in touch. Okay, hope you enjoy the show.
Morning, Alejandro. Welcome to London.
Thank you.
When did you land?
I landed the day before yesterday.
Okay, and nice to finally meet you. I think how long have we been talking now?
I think about a month or two, a couple months.
Was it the petrodollar conversation? We kind of crossed paths.
Yes, we were on Twitter. I usually find people that that I want to meet on Twitter. I think it was a couple, maybe in February or mm-hmm. March, where it all exploded because they had the Petro launch and it was a shit show, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's maybe when we connected.
And people should know that you are from Venezuela.
I'm from Venezuela. I was born and raised, lived most of my life there.
Okay, great.
That's my story.
Well, so you know my podcast, you know, it originally started out with traders and I'm finding more interesting conversations to talk about. And obviously we're in this rampant crypto bull market for the last few years, a lot of speculation, but you know, there's a lot of questions about is anyone actually really using crypto and Bitcoin, but the Venezuela is a great example where it is. So I think this is going to be a really interesting conversation. So I think we should start by, can you just give a bit about your background and tell us what life was like growing up in Venezuela? And then I think we should talk about Venezuela now so people understand the difference.
Absolutely. And I think you're spot on. I think Venezuela is a place where cryptocurrency is actually being used, not only for speculation, but for other purposes. So I think it's definitely spot on. Let's say I was born in 1990. Venezuela was a place where everything it was problematic. Let's say it was it was run by elites. It was a very unequal place, and it had, you know, lots of problems like all countries do. But we had manageable problems. We had problems like Colombia does now, for example. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great to establish a parallel between the Colombia of today and Venezuela of 1990, because we are very similar culturally, and Colombians were coming in to Venezuela back when it was bad, you know, because there was rampant crime and, you know, Pablo Escobar and all that. So it was a more stable country that had, like, you know, in the 50s and 60s, we had one of the most stable currencies in the whole continent. We were actually a country where people would emigrate to. It was a prosperous country. You know, my grandparents, they're from Spain, from one side of the family, and they fled the Spanish Civil War aftermath to come to Venezuela and to work, you know, from scratch. My grandpa was a carpenter, and he just started from scratch in Venezuela. He made it good. You know, he was able to buy a house. He was able to have like a normal middle class family life, and it was a country where people would go to. So in the 1990, like when I was born, that decade was relatively stable economically. You know, things were looking up. You know, my dad had a stable job. We had a very peaceful middle class existence for a while. Mm-hmm. But that all started to change in 1998.
When Hugo Chavez was elected.
Elected, okay. Yes, because he painted himself as the savior, the messiah. You know, like he had been involved in a coup in 1992. So he was always a military man. He was always, you know, you could tell that if you looked closely enough, he looked authoritarian and militaristic, but he also had such charisma that many people overlooked that. They overlooked his more authoritarian character. So he painted himself as someone who was like a middle way candidate. So he didn't, in the beginning, this is I think important, he didn't paint himself as a socialist or communist or whatever. He said that Cuba was a dictatorship and that he didn't want to establish socialism in Venezuela. He wanted to have more private companies come in and make profits and so on. So like he really deceived everyone when he was saying those things. I don't know if intentionally, like if he had like real plans to actually be a middle way candidate, or, you know, he was from the start compromised. Like some people say that he was trained by the Castros, know, in Cuba, whatever. Like I don't know, because those, like, you get into the conspiracy theory mm-hmm. territory there. But the fact is that Cubans nowadays have a lot of a say on what goes on in Venezuela today, mm-hmm. and that's not something that is only conspiracy theory. Like it's something that is very difficult to research and to talk about, you know, in serious settings. But it is something that is real. Like the like right now, Chavez led the infiltration of Cuban mindset and Soviet style central planning into Venezuela, and that has been his main contribution, if you want to say it, okay. in a way, to society. So like we have shifted from a system where it was more, you know, maybe more aligned with U.S. and the West, to a system where we kind of want to be like super independent from everything. Like I think the tenet of, or the core value of the Maduro government and well, Chavez before him, is that they want to show that Venezuela can make it on its own. Mm-hmm. And they want to show that there is another way of doing things different from the US and the West. And so they're not fan of like trading with other nations that are that are colonialist or you know, capitalist, like all those things are like bad words for them. So it's not fair game. So they want to be trading with people in countries like Bolivia and like the rest of South America, which has, you know, I don't think it's inherently bad, but I think they are closing up to a lot of opportunities to work together with societies that are way more advanced. And we have closed off those avenues. And that's just really sad.
Right. And then so in 1999, the Venezuelan constitution was changed.
Yeah. He changed the Venezuelan constitution because he wanted to change the name of a bunch of things. Because when you control the names, when you kind of change the setting, I think you have an advantage that most people don't recognize, because we humans are, we care deeply about how things are named and how like it's all part of a story, right? Mm-hmm. So he established the myth. One of the things he changed with the new constitution was the name of the republic. So he said, now we're going to be called the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. And he established a relationship between him and the longtime hero of Venezuela, which is Simón Bolívar. Simón Bolívar was the guy who, let's say, liberated Venezuela from the Spaniards. Like, that's like the myth that they teach you in school,
right?
Over and over again. But when you go to higher education and you find out that the war between Spain and Venezuela wasn't very clear cut. It was more like a revolt by the Venezuelan elites that wanted to seize power, because they just happened to be born in Venezuela, and they couldn't hold power because Spain required the people who were going to rule Venezuela to have been born in Spain. So Simón Bolívar was a guy who was just like sore because he was just being born in Venezuela, and he just wanted to rule. And, you know, you can see that, like, he, like, lots of people now say that he was a Democrat and he was, you know, he had, like, high ideals, and they compare him to the founding fathers of the U.S., but I think that's not a fair comparison, because he wanted things like hereditary Senate for him and his palace. I don't, if you analyze his doctrine, I think you will see that he didn't have such liberal values as people claim.
Right.
That it is. So, like, what to recap, Chavez and now Maduro, they are like putting themselves in that setting where they, even though, like, I have all these criticisms of Bolívar, and I think that's not a mainstream position in Venezuela, people adore Bolívar. People really care for Bolívar, and because we are hammered all of that ever since, like, since we're growing up. In, like, first grade in school, you have to study the history of Venezuela, and they really touched on the fact that Bolívar was the one who liberated us, and these are the heroes of the fatherland, and so on. And what he did was very important, because he established a direct relationship between himself and Bolívar.
So hence the Bolivarian Revolution.
Exactly. So he...
So
co-opted the name of Bolívar. Now Bolivarianism is kind of a bad word nowadays, because if you associate with Bolívar or Bolivarian Revolution, you automatically are associating with the Chavista regime. And that's, I mean, I'm not a big fan of Bolívar, as you can tell,
yeah.
but I think lumping together those things has been able to serve Chavez and his cronies very well. Because it's something that definitely most Venezuelans believe in. It's a myth. It's a foundational myth for our society that Bolívar was inherently good and he liberated us from the Spaniards. So Chavez established a relationship with him, and now it's equivalent to say that Chavez is the next or the new Bolívar. That's what
right.
he wanted to do.
Okay.
And he accomplished that because he was a very charismatic man.
But he only accomplished it for a period of time, right?
Yes. So, I think if you, that's a tricky subject, because most people, if you were to poll people in Venezuela today, they would still endorse Chavez and his policies, because he just died at just the right time when he didn't have to face the consequences of what he did.
So talk about what the changes he implemented, the socialist changes that he implemented in Venezuela at the time.
So, yeah, this is funny. Chavez started asking the central bank for a little billion. It's a famous phrase. He said, a millardito. It's like literally means a little billion. And the central bank said, okay, we'll do it. Like he asked, like directly asked the central bank to print money to finance his revolution because, you know, he had a higher purpose in mind. So, of course, you know, the central bank would grant him that because he, you know, the whole country was kind of ideologically aligned with him. Like the majority of people had voted for him. Mm-hmm. So in that time, like around 1998, 99, and you know, my family wasn't a part of this because they kind of always saw that he was coming from a military background and an authoritarian background. They had bad feelings about this.
When did you leave Venezuela, by the way, for context?
2015.
Okay, so actually not too long ago. No. Wow. Okay. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, so Chavez... where are we?
Sorry, the socialist policies that he implemented.
Yeah, so one of the first things, and I think this a lot of Bitcoiners and a lot of crypto people will you know, critique this because they're against central banks printing mm-hmm. money, you know, without a reason for it. You know, Chavez just, they're supposed, like, in the West, in the first world, there's the principle that the central bank and the government aren't the same and they shouldn't be the same because if there's a government that wants to control institutions, they could just ask for the central bank for money and the central bank will just print it. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a very bad precedent that was set. I don't know if that was the start of the slippery slope and you know, the whole socialist collapse. But it was certainly, I think it's certainly a good thing to discuss that Chavez really leaned on that capacity of the state to be able to just print currency out of thin air for a while. So like it wasn't just like one little billion of bolivares. He actually printed more.
And again, for context, what was the exchange rate at that point, say, to the US dollar?
Wow.
So what would would you know?
I have very little idea of what it was. I think maybe...
I mean, I can research that and add it to the show notes.
No, the problem is, even if, like when you're researching it, the problem is that the Bolivar has changed denominations many times. So, yeah, like, yeah. They have reconverted the Bolivar. They have like slashed zeros out of the Bolivar a lot of times.
Okay.
So like back then... I really don't know.
But it was a lot of money.
You know, the Bolivar was a kind of stable currency if you mm-hmm. compare it to other currencies in Latin America. Mm-hmm. We certainly had problems with inflation because Latin America as a whole has had problems with inflation. But it wasn't a worthless currency like it is now.
Right,
certainly.
Okay.
So yeah, it was a lot of money that they printed. And they said that they wanted to use it for good.
Yep.
They said they wanted to use it for social programs and so on. But that created a really bad precedent for just financing whatever Chavez had in mind. So like he became the mastermind of the Venezuelan plan, you know, the central planner of everything. And, you know, he maybe you could say that he had some good ideas, but he had a lot of other bad ideas.
Yeah.
So that's where we start.
Well, I mean, I guess a lot of socialists and socialist policies are come from good intention.
Yes, or at least they claim to come from good intentions.
So what are the things that Chavez started to put in place then? What are the changes that really started to affect the economy in Venezuela?
So what Chavez aimed to do was, or at least in theory, was to reduce poverty in Venezuela. That, mm-hmm. I think that was his stated goal. But obviously, he failed massively at it. He, like right now, if you look at when Chavez came to power, I think poverty, I mean, I don't know, I'm not really sure about these numbers, but poverty was like at a point where maybe 38% of Venezuelans were in poverty. Now it's way more than that. Now mm-hmm. it's like maybe 90%. So
right.
He, like, basically what he did doesn't work, of course, but his stated goal was to reduce it. And for a while, he appeared to be successful because the oil prices in Venezuela and everywhere, like in the market, they were going up.
Mm-hmm.
So he just had the very good fortune to come to power in a time where oil was very valuable and he could do a lot with the money that we had.
And what kind of things was he doing?
So most of the money, this is also very difficult to research and a very touchy subject, but I think that it's if we want to start this discussion, I think the first thing to recognize is that most of the money that he or that he managed, you know, like the money that was coming into Venezuela because of the huge oil prices, mm-hmm. we had a boom, really. And I think what we have to understand is that most of that money probably today sits in offshore bank accounts for like you know, government cronies, you know, like you know, you remember the Swiss leaks in 2016?
Yeah.
So if you look at the bank accounts of just that one specific Swiss bank, you'll see that the majority of like, if you look by nationality, I think most people who hold accounts in that bank are US, second China, and third Venezuela. So this is like, you know, Venezuela is a small country and it's not a very rich country, like especially by today's standards. So why does Venezuela have, or like Venezuela citizens that, you know, are very probably tied to the government have such like huge balances in it, just one Swiss bank account? That tells you, that starts you to unravel a story about how they they funneled most of the money that came from the oil wealth to their for their personal profit. So I think it was like something like $11 billion or something like that, which is, you know, in Venezuela, it's a lot of money objectively speaking, but also in Venezuela, that could solve really a lot of problems. Like if you look at the international reserves of Venezuela, it's only $10 billion. So it's $10 billion. Mm-hmm. So it's a significant number. So I think going back a little bit, the Chavez government, I think first we have to recognize that they were better at corruption, and I mean that they were more blatant about it. They were more. They just didn't care. Like the corruption was just a part of their game, and everyone kind of, this is like an open secret in Venezuela that everyone knows that Chavez and his cronies were corrupt. Some people say that Chavez himself wasn't corrupt. That doesn't really matter that much because he enabled the whole network of corruption that came with him. So that's the first thing we have to understand. But so if you look a little bit into that network of corruption, they justified it by financing some things that were needed. In the Venezuelan state. So they established some social programs that were very ineffective and they weren't run by academics, so they no one knows their numbers of like how, you know, if you're running a poverty reducing scheme, you better measure it and you better, you know, how it's how it's running. If you're running a scheme that aims to reduce illiteracy, then you better also have numbers for that. But then the Chavista government never cared to have numbers for that. And they just wanted to be able to claim that they had social programs and programs for the poor to like target poverty. And that was it. So as long as they were able to claim that and funnel most of the money to their offshore bank accounts, that was fine. Okay. That was the state of affairs for, I think, most of the time I was growing up. And most of the time up until Maduro came to power in 2013, when Chavez died and everything, you know, kind of precipitated.
But when did you start his, you know, you as a, you know, because you were a child at that time, but transitioned into adulthood.
Yes.
Also, obviously, your parents were there and working. When did you yourself started to notice a real change in society, and also you've obviously talked to your parents about it. When did it started to really impact them?
So yeah, I think that's a good question. My parents moved. So I have, let's say, a half Venezuelan, half Spanish heritage. Mm-hmm. My grandparents moved from Spain, fleeing the civil war, to Venezuela in the 1960s, and I've always had like that mixed heritage, and my Venezuelan side of the family has been, you know, the closest one, the one like we always meet, we always go together to events, and we have, you know, like we're very tight. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the subject of leaving Venezuela or like discussing how bad things were was on the table, I think, until maybe 2011, 2012. Like that wasn't readily apparent to most people in Venezuela until, you know, I think institutions had reached a point where it was very clear that Chavez controlled them. And it was very clear that we were very subject to oil prices. And, mm-hmm. and you know, in 2011 was still a year of relatively good oil prices for Venezuela. And but you could see, like, if you looked beyond the prosperity.
Sorry, and I'm reading here, $22.5 billion of public funds have been transferred from Venezuela to foreign accounts.
Yeah, well, that's probably a conservative estimate, yeah.
Right. So, sorry, apologies, I interrupted.
Yeah.
So so the problem seemed to be split between corruption and policy.
Yes, and the problem is that they justify their corruption, or they do this like locally, and this doesn't make much sense to most people, because in the West it's unthinkable to justify corruption. But I think that in Venezuela they like, people are willing to overlook corruption if there are social programs in place that appear to be working. Mm-hmm. And that's what really put us over the edge, because Chavez had programs that were social in nature, and that, you know, he was looking to expand education and the reach of the healthcare system and so on. I say he was looking. I don't know if he had those intentions or really never had those intentions, but at least from the outside and to like lefties everywhere in the globe, he had that, you know, initiative to try to take what other Venezuelan governments had done in the past, because Chavez wants to claim that he was the first Venezuelan president who had a sense for the poor, and that's not true, because we have had the poor for many, many years. And we, for example, the oil industry has been nationalized since 1970. And if you only read Venezuelan propaganda, you would think that, oh, it was, you know, Master Chavez who did it.
Right.
We've had social programs for a long time, and we've had social programs that were much more effective than Chavista social programs. The thing is that he created a very good story to you know, stand behind, and to say that, you know, Chavez is a person that really cares about the poor. And it was just mostly rhetoric, but it worked for him.
Okay. And so when the oil prices started to slide from, I think, was it $120 a barrel down to what,
like
30, 40?
It was crazy. Yes. That slide was insane. And the Venezuelan state had grown to
do you know what percentage of the economy was reliant upon?
So, oil? Yeah, I have a number. We will have to double check this.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yes. But I think about a third of Venezuelans were working for the state in 2014, you know, when the collapse sort of like kind of started happening. So this is insane. Like, can you imagine a country of 30 million people where a third of the population works for the state? You know,
that's unreal.
That's really, it's a very bad signal, because, I mean, if a state is that large, what is it really doing?
Yeah.
Like, is it really... I think there could be a way to justify it, but what other state has that size? Like, you know, like we know of no precedent to that.
North Korea, the 100%.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the oil prices slide.
Yeah.
Less income for the government. I'm guessing. So we get to a point here where they can't pay the staff. When did the capitulation start? What started to happen? Because from everything I read, there was, under Chavez, there was currency devaluation.
Yes.
Hyperinflation, you know, shortages on basic...
Well, I think we didn't reach the point of hyperinflation in the Chavez years. Only reached that recently, I think last year. It was a long time coming. Like, we knew where this would lead. And the main thing, I think, so Chavez had a lot of policies that were, you know, that kind of signaled where things were going. So, like, the unscrupulous printing of money, mm-hmm. that was one thing. The very strong dependence on oil, and, you know, the fact that he only cared about the oil output of things, and he, you know... The oil industry was paramount, and it still is in our economy. So he didn't care for diversifying the economy in any way. So mm-hmm. he had some like maybe fake attempts at having, like, producing our own food, like having food sovereignty and so on. And because that was very political, and that was very, you know, it sold like as a story. Oh yeah, we now have, you know, he called it gallinero vertical. It's like a place where you have the hens and you know, like, but it, like, vertically, because it takes up less space. So he wanted to, like, start this movement. It's a very hipster thing. Like, this, like, everyone in the cities should farm and should have, like, their own parcel, like, very small parcel of land where he produces his own food and so on. And it sounds very, very appealing. And, you know, the hipsters nowadays, like, they use that. And, but, you know, if you, like, get real to the numbers, it's impossible to feed a society based on the just producing food in the city. You absolutely need the countryside, and you absolutely need to be more efficient at the way you actually produce food. So it's there were lots of programs like that like looked great in on paper, but they had no chance of working.
Okay, so Chavez dies. Mm-hmm. Good timing for him, really, because did he get to die a hero still in a number of people's eyes?
Yes, okay. I think so.
Okay, so a new election.
Yes.
And in comes Nicolas Maduro. Mm-hmm. A close election, right?
Yes, and I would say that election was cheated. Like, that was a cheat.
Right.
Because it was very close. And
that was against Henrique Capriles?
Enrique Capriles,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, I can't. Sorry, my Spanish accent is nothing like yours. Okay, so you suspect it was a fraudulent election?
Yes, I suspect so.
And why is that?
There's troves of evidence for, you know, electoral abuse. There's, you know, evidence of people standing behind the voters when they were voting for for candidates. So, like, there's coerced voting.
And what was Maduro's relationship with Chavez?
He was very close to Chavez in a very personal way, I think. Okay. And he was... There were a lot of people like that. Like, the government is full of, like, you know, Diosdado Cabello. There's other characters that kind of fit that bill. But I think Maduro, what distinguished him is that he was also very close to the Cubans.
Right.
So he was the appointed successor to Chavez only because, and this is, you know, my opinion, but I think I share it with most Venezuelans that I know, is that Chavez wanted to ensure that Cuba still got the oil wealth, like part of the oil wealth that Venezuela produced, because Cuba, you know, Cuba had a really hard time when they're coming out of the special period, like after the Soviet Union collapsed. No, like, Cuba is an island and it doesn't produce what it needs to feed its population. You know, like, all societies that are, you know, communist or not engaged in the global economy, they are struggling. And they were struggling in the 90s, certainly. And they needed an outsider to fund them. They just needed someone to be able to provide what they don't have. And Venezuela fit that bill.
Right.
And Chavez took care really early on in his presidency to cater to... I think it was because he hated the U.S. and he hated, you know, everything that the West represents. He wanted to, like, boycott everything. And he just wanted to help out countries like Cuba and like Bolivia that were traditionally poor.
Okay.
And that he felt were being ostracized by the establishment, like by the establishment of nations. And, you know, that's debatable. That's, you know, that's always a point where things get ideological. The lefties of the world will tell you that it's the U.S. fault that Cuba has been struggling for so long. And the right wings, they will say that it's only because they don't have a sensible, know, capitalist society that they're struggling. I lean more towards the latter. I think there's good arguments to be put in place for both, but it's certainly the case that Cuba needed Venezuela, and they needed outside funding, and that tells you a great deal about, like, how if you are dependent on other people and other countries to fund your own state. That tells you that, you know, you're not sustainable on your own, and you are probably not going down a good path.
But we talked about this, like, South America, Central America seem to have a history of socialism and Marxist policies, which it can't seem to move away from.
Yeah, yeah. And that has a lot to do with Cuba, because there's a romanticism that Cuba is sort of a society where things aren't that bad. I think Cuba has never been painted as an example of, you know, this is what we should aim for. But
the media portrayal.
If you're far away from Cuba, you can have a lot of propaganda saying that Cuba is great. Like there's lots of sources that say that, for example, the Cuban medicine and the Cuban way of life is preferable. They say that, you know, like people live more humane lives there and so on. I really don't believe that's the case. I think that they are oppressed and they can't speak against, like they can't stand for freedom. They can't speak against their government freely. They can't access, like the medical care is free, but is it really that good? I really highly doubt that.
But it doesn't help, I guess, with any historical media representation of Castro and Guevara are revolutionary heroes.
Right. Yeah, that's part of the whole story. And like I think Chavez wanted to be
one of those.
Yeah. And he succeeded, at least in Venezuela. I think he's still seen as one of those. So okay, Maduro, let's go back to Maduro and how it, like, so he came to power and he was seen, like, he was a successor of Chavez basically because he could guarantee that Cuba had their interests in Venezuela, you know, satisfied.
But under what policies was he coming in under? What, just a natural succession to Chavez, or did he have his own policies?
It was Chavistas had such a personal movement. It was such a personality cult that they had to ride on the success of Chavez to actually position Maduro as someone who was, you know, very, you know, in their view, the word was desirable for the country. Mm-hmm. So Maduro, virtually nobody knew him before Chavez died. And it was they played their cards, like the government played their cards really well, I think, because they positioned him as they actually said these words, like, the son of Chavez, and they like tried to link him directly with Chavez and his policies and say, you know, I'm the heir of Chavez and I'm the one who's going to ensure that the, you know, comandante, the commander's orders will be executed.
Right.
It was all very, it started to have hints of authoritarianism back then. And you know, Maduro, what he did was he consolidated the power in Venezuela. And since he had a lot less charisma than Chavez did, I think that's why he had to turn into an authoritarian, because Chavez could do what he pleased, partly because of the oil prices and partly because he was very charismatic. Just like he was liked by the people, very, very much liked.
And in the 5 years since he came to power,
it's been 5 years since Maduro came to power. Oh my God!
Yeah, 2013.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, April 14th, 2013.
Yes, that's right.
So 5 years, pretty much a complete breakdown in Venezuela society.
Absolutely.
You do have hyperinflation.
Yes.
You have mass poverty.
And what Maduro has done is he's just continued, double down on the Chavista policies.
And you left in 2015.
Yes.
So what was the trigger for you to leave?
I think unsafety.
Okay.
That was the main reason. Like, a lot of people cite, like, the economic situation. For me, you know, I was...
Where in Venezuela were you?
In Caracas.
So you're in Caracas, okay.
Yeah,
so
I was born in Caracas, the capital city. I was raised in Valencia. It's a city near Caracas. But then I did my undergrad degree in Caracas. So, like, I've been in the central region of Venezuela most of my life.
Did you go to Venezuela in Spain when you were there?
What's that?
You said
Valencia.
Sorry, Valencia. Did you go to Valencia in Spain?
I've been to Valencia in Spain. Yeah.
Okay. It's a really beautiful town.
Yes.
Okay, so talk about from 2013 to 2015.
The breakdown.
Yeah, the breakdown. What visually, what were you seeing? And then the trigger for you leaving being safety. Talk about what's actually daily life.
Mm-hmm. So, Venezuela has always been a dangerous country.
Mm-hmm.
I won't deny that. I think that, you know, when you're going to college, you want to, like, open up and you want to party at night and you want to do things, you know. And in Venezuela, it's very difficult to do so because, you always have this, like your parents really, of course, care a great deal about you, and they're trying to get you exposed to little danger. And it's just very dangerous to, like, objectively go out at night in Caracas, unless, you know, maybe you have like a, if you're very rich, you can have like a armored car and like all that shebang. But if you are in, you know, like normal middle class existence, obviously you don't have access to that. So when you're going out at night, it's very dangerous. You have to, like, the threat model that you have there is like you have to watch out for people trying to kidnap. Like, the kidnappers are rampant. Like, they're everywhere. If you're at a party and you're leaving and it's dark outside, you will probably face, you know, lots of people who want to either kidnap you or rob you, or it's really, like, I think part of it is that the parents, like, they care so much about you, and they maybe exaggerate the risk a lot. But I think it's objectively, like, if you look at the murder rate in Caracas, it's very high, and especially compared to the region. Latin America is one of the most violent places in the world, and Caracas is certainly one of the highest in that list. So that's okay. So that's one reason. Economics wise, you also have, if you're working for a local company and you're earning wages in Bolivares, and, you know, like, the company has to deal with the local economy and so on, it was already starting to break down, like, because the government was printing a lot of money, and, like, the Bolivar wasn't just, it just broke down as a store of value a long time ago. It also was breaking down as a means of exchange, you know, I think around 2015 or so, because if you had a reasonably demanded or sought after job, like, you know, software engineering or designer, it was easier to just set your rate in dollars and to just say, and that this is where we get to also the unit of account, right? So if you wanted to provide your services, the Bolivar was just wasn't a good way to say, hey, I want to earn this much Bolivars a month, because, you know, every month it would like the number would change a little bit. Right. And this wasn't like hyperinflation. So the definition of hyperinflation is, the academic definition is 50% inflation every month.
Right. Okay.
Right. So back in 2015 when I left, it wasn't like that, but it was high enough that you could notice a difference month to month.
Right.
So you could notice definitely that you were spending more and more and more money every month. So obviously you wanted, if you had a sought after position, you would negotiate with your employer so you got your rate in dollars, or, you know, denominated at least. Like, if you could be transferred Bolivares, because back then it was, you know.
And would it be a case that you would exchange money into dollars to protect it at the time, or you
absolutely
would spend it quickly?
Absolutely. The problem is that Chavez instituted a policy back in the day in 2003, I think, where you could not exchange dollars, like, between Bolivares and dollars. So we've had an exchange ban for over 15 years.
But was there any way to circumvent that, like, black market?
There is a black market, okay. Yes. It's very inefficient. So you typically, what you have to do, or what you had to do before Bitcoin came around, or, like, became mainstream, at least, was to find another person who wanted to buy dollars from you. Like, you had to do all the market making things, and then you need two pairs of accounts. So you need, like, maybe two accounts in the US or in Europe or wherever, and then you need two accounts in Venezuela. And you say, okay, I wanna sell you this much Bolivares. Like, how much are you gonna, like, what's the rate you're gonna give me? And then it was like a long process, but you could kind of circumvent the Forex exchange ban that way.
Could you spend dollars?
How so?
So if say you were you're paid in Venezuelan currency, but
yeah,
you changed it to dollars. Were people buying and selling with dollars
well,
from each other, knowing it's a more stable currency?
I think it's hard to say. Maybe nowadays they are, because I mean, it's just very difficult to denominate anything in bolivares. So I think,
what's inflation at right now?
I have no idea. Okay. Like, it's way over the 50% per month threshold.
And right.
That's I think maybe 7,000% per year. Like, if you put it into yearly terms, these numbers, they're really, really difficult to analyze, because 7,000% for a person doesn't mean, like, okay, I mean, if a developed nation has 3 or 4% inflation a year, that you have that number in your head, but you just can't imagine having 7,000% inflation. That's okay. Just something that doesn't cross your mind.
This is probably a really good point then to make the transition to talk about Bitcoin.
Absolutely.
But I think we should come back and touch on, you know, I find it whole fascinating, touch on the election that's coming up. But, you know, the history of Bitcoin is steeped in liberalism, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet it is now become part of the financial system. We have financial derivatives. We have the potential ETFs coming. We have futures. It's part of the economy now.
Right.
But nobody really is spending it in Western nations. It's not needed by Western nations. I don't need Bitcoin. I mean, I can use it, and I do, and it's an efficient way to pay, say, my mining contracts out in Washington. It's a very efficient way to send money. But I don't need Bitcoin. But actually, Bitcoin is needed in Venezuela, right? And it is being used. So can you tell me about when, I think it would be good for people listening to know your first exposure to crypto, when you became aware it was a thing, and then start talking about the integration and of Bitcoin within Venezuela society, the things it started to solve.
Right. Okay. So my first exposure to crypto was probably very early 2010, 2011.
Very early.
Like most people, I dismissed it. This is just a joke, right? Like,
yeah,
it's a currency. I didn't have a lot of interest for economics or for finance back then. Like, I was just a programmer, and I just wasn't really interested in it. And I bought a little bit, sold a little bit. That's, what wasn't like betting on the success or failure of Bitcoin at all. Like, I saw it maybe as like a fun experiment. But as time went by, I kind of forgot about it. I was working on other things. I worked in machine learning. I worked with user experience design. So like, that's what I've been mostly working in. I think I've found a space where I found my niche where it's I want to come together, like come in between the users and the technology, because I don't really enjoy spending my whole day just coding things. I also enjoy making them accessible to people and understanding how people think and how users actually use their products.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in the usability game. I did a master's in human computer interaction, and now I'm trying, like, now that I discovered crypto and like I kind of got back into it again, I want to make it accessible for everybody. That's going to be my mission now.
Okay.
And to recap, I was I dismissed it at first, like most everybody does. And as time went by, I had a few friends that kind of connected me back to it. And they said, like, for example, I read The Sovereign Individual, last year, or 2016 maybe. I followed like Balaji Srinivasan and the great minds of cryptocurrency, like Naval Ravikant.
Yeah.
I was on Twitter. I think that the space seemed alluring, but I never like really took the plunge up until last year. Last year, I think as a product of me, like I was visiting San Francisco for a few weeks, and this was back in October last year,
mm-hmm.
So it's very recent. And I had a friend of mine tell me about a dinner with Balaji and friends. And, I'm down for that. Balaji's such a smart guy. I wanted to listen to him and talk with him. And I think that was the time. Like, I had learned about cryptocurrency just very little by little. I hadn't fallen into the rabbit hole that most people fall into. yet, but then I kind of made the connection with Venezuela, and I think it was Balaji who like really got me to see that angle, that, you know, this thing is like a toy for us, like it's for first world nations or citizens, first world citizens. It's something of a, you know, like most of its use is speculation, you know, like it's a fun thing we play with. It's like a new finance game that we're playing. But I think for you guys, like for Venezuelans, this could actually change the game, because you've had exchange bans on your currency for over 15 years. So it's actually frowned upon it's not allowed to exchange money and to really transact with other individuals. Mm-hmm. So if you have a way to bypass that without anyone being able to censor you, that's a very powerful thing. Like, don't you realize that? And I mean, they obviously didn't say those words like directly, but I think that was kind of the message that got to me, you know, like that this is something very important, that it's a technology that could change potentially like whole economies, and I think that's how I got into it. Again, this is very recent, so I'm just getting, you know, started in the crypto game. Like I've read papers now, I've read research, and I try to keep up with the latest set of affairs. And you're
also a writer.
I write for Caracas Chronicles. Okay. I write about the situation in Venezuela and like what I know about it, and especially the interaction between technology and the technological world and what Venezuela is going through. Uh-huh. So I've written about the petrol, for example, which is like, you
know, yeah,
we're gonna come to that. But I've written about things that, you know, have that interaction between technology development and Venezuela.
Okay.
So
let's talk about how crypto and Bitcoin is being used in Venezuela right now.
Yeah.
And I think there's two areas. There's mining, but there's also use of a store of value and medium exchange. So we'll come to mining for a second. Let's talk about how Venezuelans are using Bitcoin on a daily basis.
Yeah, so I have a good story for you. I have a friend who bought Bitcoin at 17,000 when it was at $17,000 per Bitcoin, and but obviously what he had was bolivares.
Yeah,
and so he bought some. Like obviously he didn't buy whole Bitcoin because he didn't have the kind of money to do that. But he bought some. I don't know how much exactly. Maybe like $20 or right. $40, like something very small. And but at that price, he said, you know, like, I'm just going to buy it because I, you know, like, kind of recommended, you know, like, yeah, Bitcoin, you could use it as a store of value. That was like, I was kind of a maximalist back then, like just trying to get everyone that I knew, like involved in the movement. And when he did that, you know, looking back, it might seem like a bad business decision because now it's back at 10,000. So
yeah,
you might have think that he lost money, but actually, if you take into account that he bought it with bolivares,
yeah,
he's actually gained money from it. So if you have a currency, a native currency, that you buy something that's worth 17,000, and now it's worth much less, and you still lost less money than you would have lost just by keeping the money in your local currency. That is a currency that, you know, really, really, really doesn't work. So some say that Bitcoin can't or doesn't work like a store of value. And they cite that argument because it's so volatile. And, you know, it was at 17,000 last year, and now it's back at 10,000. But
depends where you're from.
Yeah, it depends where you're from. Like if you look at it, if your mark of reference is the Venezuelan Bolivar, I think no matter what you do, if you have something that you can trade for Venezuelan bolivares that is still very volatile, but you know you know that it's not going to drop its value by more than 50% every month, you should absolutely trade for it.
So are there are onboarding exchanges in Venezuela where you can buy Bitcoin with Bolivarian dollars?
Yes, bolivares, yeah. There are some. There's one called Crypto Buyer. Okay. There's Colibit. There's local Bitcoins, I think, is the primary one.
So is there a premium, a high premium charged?
That varies so much that I want to say yes, I think there is.
Because I know like in Zimbabwe when it was like, I don't know, Bitcoin was like $8,000. In Zimbabwe, you paid about $12,000 for Bitcoin.
Because, I don't think the premium is quite that large.
No, but I'm assuming because there is, there's a, yeah, the buyer has got a risk accepting the deflationary currency for, hyperinflation currency for what is essentially a deflationary currency. So I guess there's a risk there. I read this, did you read the Katie Vogue article? So Katie Vogue wrote an article about Bitcoin in Venezuela. And one example she had was one young man who was at the cinema. He was going to the cinema and he has his Bitcoin. And before he buys something, he transfers it back into Bolivera to buy cinema tickets to go in. But keeps pretty much the
majority, all of his
money in Bitcoin.
Value in Bitcoin.
Not only value in Bitcoin.
Very smart thing to do.
So how much exposure is there? Is it still niche in Venezuela?
I think it's fair to say that it's niche everywhere. Like, it, you know, the usability bar isn't quite there yet for most people to take into it. Like, it's
wallets and private keys and it's just too much.
That is too much right now. But I think we're getting close to the point where if you have an application like WhatsApp, like, because everyone in Venezuela uses WhatsApp and it's no problem. Like, so if you have a, so that's for example, one of the reasons why I'm bullish and I'm excited about Toshi. And like, you know, Coinbase's wallet app that has like an integrated messenger. I think like if people can learn how to use something that is very simple, that runs on their phones, and most people in Venezuela, I think, have access to a phone, then this could go, you know, very, very mainstream if you like look out for usability, right? But I think right now, yes, it is a niche, some of a niche product. Most people don't have the technological sophistication to use it, but the people that do, I think, have a very clear advantage over the ones who don't, because you know, Bitcoin is just a much better store of value than the Bolivar. Like, if you compare it to the dollar, maybe it's not such a good store of value right now, but it is compared to any currency that loses its like 50% of its value every month.
And it might even have been one of your articles, but I've read that Bitcoin is being used to buy medicine. Being used to buy food. People are actually also using Bitcoin to pay staff now.
Yes, it's a way to first circumvent the blockage that the government has with foreign currency, because it's a currency that you can freely exchange for dollars, and you can't say the same thing about Bolivares. And it also fulfills a function of store of value. Like, if it obviously is more stable than the Bolivar. And it's weird. I feel weird saying this because, you know, the dollar and the pound and everything is way more stable than Bitcoin, obviously. And you see that in the charts. But the Bolivar is just so damn bad that Bitcoin beats it in that way. So, like, even with, like, high volatility, it's more of a – you can say that Bitcoin is more of a currency than the Bolivar. And that's enough for, you know, the tech-savvy, intelligent people to start using it and to, you know, like the guy in the cinema, just keep most of his savings there. And I have friends who are doctors and friends who are, you know, journalists and stuff that they earn some, like, part of their, because they read, sometimes they write for Caracas Chronicles. So we have voluntary contributions from around the world. So we earn some, like, few dollars every month and we distribute them to the writers. Like, depending on, like, you know, how many pieces they write and so on. So they have a, like, a part of their salary that it's paid, it, like, denominated in dollars, but then it's paid in Bolivares because that's the local currency, and that's why they actually need to, like, buy food and you know be like live in Venezuela. But I found that, you know, many of my friends who write for Caracas Chronicles, for example, and are doctors or economists, or, you know, that they're smart enough, they are switching to a model where they keep most of what they earn either in dollars, in like some, because most people don't have access to like a bank account in the US or anything like that, but they have like virtual accounts, like in services like RTM or GetLosi or Uphold.com, like these like virtual wallets that hold dollars. So they have part of their savings there, but they also have part of their savings in Bitcoin, because they know that it's also a currency that they can use as a as a store of value and as an intermediary between bolivares and dollars and other currencies.
Can you could you ever foresee reaching a point where Bitcoin or crypto becomes a national currency in Venezuela? Could it be the first example outside of the petrodollar? Could you see Bitcoin taking over?
I think so. I think it's possible that if we lower the usability bar enough, it is a reality that you know many people in Venezuela have access to a mobile phone, and they could have access to advanced technology like this. It's not unfeasible.
Because I've read about, from the background of a Bitcoin maximalist, the hyper-Bitcoinization.
Yes.
Like, it feels like what's happening in Venezuela is the very early stage of that.
Yes. I would agree with that. I think that there's a trickier case for countries that are stable, because people mostly prefer fiat. Like, if you're honest, if you look at it really closely, I think you'll find that most people that live in societies like the UK or the US or Europe, they really prefer their national currencies. Like, because they're stable, they work for them. I think it's in a country where money has stopped working that you could really have that shift between, you know, like where you totally abandon fiat and you go for something that is actually
you can trust.
Yeah, that you can trust that maybe, because most people won't understand how it works, obviously, but they will know that, I think over time they will learn that it's the value of the currency can't be artificially manipulated by the government. And I think most people aren't aware of that. Like, they're not aware of the incredible influence that the government has on the value of the bolivar, because they don't know that. They can't comprehend, or they haven't had the chance to study the fact that every time the government prints money, they are becoming poorer. I think it's going to be like coming as an intuition. So if they see Bitcoin as holding its value for some time, I think they'll say, well, this is obviously a preferable currency. What am I doing just holding my bolivares when I can just bypass all of this and transfer and interact with other people economically just using this other currency, which I also don't know how it works, but whatever. I think they'll find that it's intuitively, it just works better for them. So with the breakdown of the Bolivar, we have witnessed kind of a return to the barter system. Like, some people are... And it's partly because there's also a cash scarcity in Venezuela. So, like, the government is printing money, but, like, in quotes, they're not really printing it. Like, the bills, they're doing some sort of quantitative easing where they're just, like, copy-pasting the bolivares. So most of the money that is actually being created in Venezuela right now is digital. So I think it's a historic low value right now. I think maybe 3% or something like that. Only 3% of the bolivares that exist are in cash, in physical form. The rest are just digital, so the government is pushing that strategy because it's cheap. It's cheaper for them if they want to keep that model of printing and printing and printing. It's obviously cheaper for them to print digitally than print physically. Mm-hmm. But I think what they're achieving is, and I think this is a good thing. They are accustoming, like, they're trying to get people acquainted with the concept of digital money.
Okay,
and so they might start their financial interactions with others in digital with the bolivar, because there's a digital bolivar, and like the transfers back and forth between people and bolivares are very, very common. And, you know, the cash is very scarce and it's difficult to conduct transactions in it. But that sets the stage, and a very interesting stage for other currencies to come in, and Bitcoin in particular.
And is cash scarce because they can't print new denominations quickly enough?
Partly, yes.
I mean, I've seen ridiculous pictures on Twitter where people are taking bags full of money to buy things.
Oh, yeah. You know, there is a premium for using debit and credit. Or, like, you could see it the other way around. I think it's easier to see it the other way around. There is a discount for using cash. In some cities, you can pay for the exact same good half of what it's worth if you pay in cash.
Wow.
This is insane. Like,
okay, so look, we're going to come to the petrodollar. But just, I also want to touch on mining, because mining has been something which has become a profitable way to earn income in Venezuela, but also becomes at risk, because I think I've read two things that people are wanting to rob people of their mining and equipment. I've also read that the government is using heat detection equipment to detect where mining equipment is to confiscate, but also the Venezuelan government is also mining itself. So what are you aware of the state of mining in Venezuela?
I have a few friends who are mining now, and I've become friends with other people who, you know, like friends from high school, friends from life. I can say that the mining scene in Venezuela is very, you know, well, nothing in Venezuela is normal anymore, but I think in Venezuela it's a challenge to, it's a specific challenge to mine, and it is that you kind of have to include in your list of things to do, besides, you know, getting the equipment, getting it up and running and so on, you have to include the possibility of being extorted. Like that's something that's completely normal by now. I've had friends who...
Extorted by?
By government. And it might not be, you know, central government that, you know, Maduro dictates that they must go and seize the mining equipment. I don't think it quite works like that. I think it's more of a...
Just corruption.
Yes, just corruption, and more of a, like, you know, if you are as a police officer, like you have access to the database of electrical electricity use in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And you can detect that there's some abnormal use in this apartment building, you probably are not going to notify your superiors about it. You're just going to go and check it out, and you're just going to try to get that, like, some money out of it. Because you, like, we've come to a point where police officers, like normal and regular people, are noticing that mining is just making money out of thin air. Like that's the mental model that they have for it. So they just go, like, if you have authority, if you have guns, and if you have, like, the possibility to use force, you go to a place where you think that people are mining as a police officer or, like, as an authority of any sort, and then you kindly demand payment. And you say, I see that you're mining here. You know, like, I have some guns, and why don't you give me part of your profits? Because, you know, I have guns. And that's become normal.
Wow.
That's become something that, you know, unless you run, like, a really small operation, like, if you can mask your electricity use behind, you know, like, you know, I'm, like, running an air conditioning or whatever, then, like, if you do that, you're fine. Like, probably no one's going to notice that you're doing it. But if you give indication to, you know, the problem is that they also control the government controls the electrical system. So, and there's a lot of people, I think, that have access to that database. So they can see, you know, if you have, like, a huge mining farm, a huge mining rig in rural Venezuela, where, you know, you might be, you know, outside a city, you might have, like, a better, like, more space to, like, put your rigs and, like, to be more comfortable, just having your operation there. Absolutely, you absolutely need to be in bed with government, or in some fashion, because once they realize what you're doing, and once they realize that your profits are, you know, bigger than the majority of what the Venezuelan population is producing, you know, like, and the minimum wage right now is like $3 a month. So if you have a mining operation that, you know, exceeds that, yeah, it's their incentive is to find you and to demand payment from you.
But the government is mining itself, right?
Yeah, so that has changed very recently. They used to do that in a very unofficial fashion. And I think the central government kind of decided that they wanted a cut. Like, they just wanted, they don't want to, like, they don't want to corrupt, they didn't want corrupt police force to take the whole cake from the mining earnings and so on. So they wanted, like, the central government wanted a cut of it. So they said, okay, we're just going to regulate it. We're going to say that you, if you are mining, you have to register in this central registry. And if not, like if you don't register, we're going to extort you. And if you do, we're going to tax you. So you really have no choice.
Right, okay. So
they are, so to answer your question, they have become aware that you can make money out of thin air. And for the Venezuelan government, that's always been a very appealing proposition. They have, after all, been making money out of thin air from the oil fields.
Right.
You know, basically out of thin air. You know, like this, just pumping oil out of the ground and selling it. For them, it's what they are used to do.
Right.
So this is just like a new iteration of it. Oh, yeah. Like a
digital version.
A digital version, yes.
Right, okay. Yeah. So let's talk about the Petro, the crypto Petro. Let's talk about the when it launched, which was kind of a, we would call a clusterfuck. What happened?
That's a very appropriate term.
What the intentions were and what you understand about the current state of the Petro.
Okay. So since the government realized that they can make money out of thin air with mining, they, you know, ICOs were a big thing last year.
Mm-hmm.
And that fact didn't escape the government. They are always trying to find new ways of financing because ever since they were cut off from the mainstream financial system when sanctions were enacted and so on, like Venezuela was forbidden to take on more debt on financial markets and they were looking for a way out. So the Petro really appealed to, the possibility of issuing a coin and running an ICO really appealed to them because it's an easy way to, or they thought it would be an easy way to raise funds and just
much needed funds,
and to basically to stay in power. Because I don't want to say that they're needed funds, like that they're not, most likely not going to fund development using that. It's just money that they need to keep themselves in power because they have costs, like they have very real costs. And if the government runs out of money today, the government will fall today because everything runs on incentives. And the military people that surround Maduro, they have to eat and they have to have an apartment in Miami and they have to, you know, like they care about these things. They,
right.
They like everyone else, I think, are self-interested.
And the Petro is backed by the oil.
That's what they say. Yeah.
One barrel for every Petro.
That's also what they say, yeah.
So essentially around $60.
Because, so this is a very interesting thing. If you go to coglow.com, there's like a list of cognitive biases that, you know, people fall into. And this is a very interesting example of anchoring, right? Because... Mm-hmm. Once you have the price for something, like in your, you know, an iPhone now costs like $1,000, and you know Apple has successfully done that, like that you now think, you know, the iPhone X is $1,000, so they'll keep selling you iPhones for $1,000, even though a few years ago it's $600, right?
Yeah,
and they have successfully established that like new pricing point. So the government is doing the same with the petrol. They're saying that, you know, a barrel of oil is roughly $60. So we will sell this cryptocurrency for $60 each because, you know, like it basically represents a barrel of oil, but in no way it does. Like if you read the white paper closely, you will find, and I think Vitalik also like critiqued this on Twitter, you'll find that what they promised to do is to give you the Bolivar denominated value of a barrel of oil at the rate that they fix, in exchange for your petrol. So like the guarantee that it has is that the government will sell you, like they will give you bolivares, which they can print, you know, freely, and they can use a rate that they want. Like there's no, absolutely no guarantee that this in any way resembles the price or the actual value of a barrel of oil.
And it was launched, on NEM, the NEM protocol?
That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
And are we aware that any were actually purchased from the ICO?
Well, I know only of anecdotal evidence for it. I registered on the platform, and it's a joke because you have to put in your passport. Like they ask for like specific things, like you have to put in your passport or your ID card and so on. I just wanted to see how mediocre they were when they built their platform, and I uploaded a blank image as my passport, and they granted me access. So that gives you an idea of like how, like what kind of KYC they're doing, right? Like this is not KYC at all.
But didn't they claim billions were sold?
They claimed that they sold like $3 billion or something. I know, so like obviously that number is bogus, and I think talking about numbers doesn't make much sense because we have no idea how much they really sold. What we do know about numbers is that as of today, like last time I checked, I checked like a week ago or so, but I think as we speak, the state of the blockchain, if you look at the NEM blockchain, the Petros are mostly, like, they're concentrated in four or five different addresses. So they seem not to have been distributed yet, even though they already kind of closed the ICO because they said, you know, we've gathered this much and we have stopped selling them. But they're still taking payments from people. So they are, when they started this ICO, they started taking euros, rubles, you know, like they had this like Russian bank account where they received like fiat money. And they also had crypto accounts, like, and a system where if you log into their platform, they give you a unique address that you have to transfer to. So you can transfer Ether or Bitcoin or whatever. And then you register your NEM address, and supposedly they're going to transfer you money. Petros, right?
Yeah.
Not money. But
this hasn't happened yet.
This, as far as I know, hasn't happened yet.
Right, okay.
And for example, on Twitter, there's a guy that I was able to verify that he had transferred about $7,000 to the Maduro, like to one of the addresses that he was given by the system.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I mean, he hasn't gotten anything yet. He's obviously very pissed, and he doesn't want this story to be like doesn't want to be identified or anything. But I could verify that this guy. You know, he showed me screenshots of like the whole interface that the government has for the ICO, and he actually appeared to transfer that money. Like, if you look on the blockchain, the transfer in Ether exists. So this guy actually seemed to have spent a lot of money on this.
Wow!
And he just hasn't gotten anything back.
Wow!
So yeah,
and I also read hasn't Maduro made an offer to India that they could buy oil at a 30% discount if they use the petro?
That's, yeah. That was, I think, last week. Yeah.
So what do you think is going to happen with the petro?
I think it's going to... I mean, first, they have to distribute the petros that they sold. I think they are definitely going to do that. I don't think they're going to... I mean, it is a scam, but it's a scam where at least they're going to get... the tokens out because they have. I don't see why they wouldn't do it because the tokens are worthless anyways. Like it cost the government like $30 to print 100 million petros, which is what they printed or issued, right? And it would be foolish of them not to actually distribute them.
Mm-hmm.
But so it will come down to like the government claims to be accepting petros, you know, sometime in the future. But what they really need is dollars. What they really need is like is Bitcoin or Ether, whatever is like a form of sound money to you. They need that to finance themselves. They can't, if they pay their goons in petro and the petro can't buy you anything else, it won't work. And they know it.
But aren't they trying to integrate the petro as a form of payment within Venezuela? I've read about I've read about the youth bank, and I've also read about I think, is there a hotel that's going to be accepting it? They're starting
it's
to
probably a government run hotel,
but they're attempting to at least try and make it some form of medium exchange. Skeptical?
Yes. I am very skeptical. Like, of course they're going to try to do these things because they want to show the utility of the petro. But I think it's a money-losing game. Like, they are, for every hotel room that they book that they accept petros for instead of dollars, and for every, you know, oil industry supply that they accept in petros instead of dollars and so on, it's just money that they already collected because the petrol has already been sold. And let's be very optimistic and assume that they have raised $3 billion in petrols. $3 billion for a state is almost nothing.
Mm.
It buys them almost no time. So are they really going to accept this new currency that they created that isn't bringing them any fresh money besides the $3 billion that they supposedly raised?
Yeah.
Like, if you have the ability to charge in Bitcoin or to charge in dollars for your services, like, if your services are really valuable to people, first, like, there's very few people that actually hold petrol. So, like, who's going to be able to pay you first? Like, that's the first problem that they have to face.
Mm-hmm.
And then second, the petrol isn't inherently worth anything. Like, it's just worth whatever they say it is. And if they keep accepting it, it's going to be a system where they actually pre-collected all of the money. So they actually limited the economy. So assuming, like, having the very, very optimistic use or case that the petrol raised $3 billion, then, okay, so the petrol is a $3 billion economy. So are they able to grow from there?
Yeah.
Are they able to, like, use that to raise more money? Like, I don't see it. Like, I see they fell for this. Like, I think someone very clever kind of talked to them about the idea.
About
running the ICO.
Yeah.
It's probably a bunch of Russians who wanted to make a killing on this. So obviously they're doing fine because,
yeah,
you know, they probably have a cut of all the petrols that are sold. So yeah, it's great for them. They probably made a couple million bucks. But for a state, I think this is going to be disastrous.
Well, the National Assembly, the Venezuelan National Assembly,
mm-hmm,
called it an illegal debt issuance.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And it's up to, I think, everywhere in, like, liberal democracies, it's up to parliament to decide when to go into debt, and because they represent the people, right?
Right.
And in this case, the government claims, like, so they raised whatever they have raised in future claims of oil fields that have not been developed. So even if the oil fields that are supposedly backing the petrol have no development whatsoever. Like, they're just like fields that you wouldn't know that have oil unless you, like, really, really knew about it. But it's, there's absolutely no. I think you need, like, an investment of $5 to $10 billion to actually start developing those fields.
Wow.
So it's a promise to potential investors to, like, that they have a claim on Venezuelan oil, but it's clearly not. Like, it's something that the Venezuelan government made up to just put the value of the petrol in something, and whatever money they raised, they limited it to the money that they were able to collect, right? And
we're fast approaching my longest ever interview, by the way. This is just, we've flown through this.
Yeah.
Conscious of time.
Yes.
I've got to go get a plane.
Yes, of course.
I think we should definitely do this again. But
yeah,
I do want to close out on a couple of things. You've got an election coming up soon. So I think it's important we close the circle on the political situation.
Okay.
I think it would be interesting to share, because you have an election that's been delayed.
Yes.
It's
been anticipated also. Like, it wasn't supposed to happen now.
Well, no, but 20th of May, it's been penciled in for, right, apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
Yet the leading opposition candidates have been barred from voting.
Uh-huh.
So just explain the current situation. How do you think this is going to play out? And then also, it'd be good to know, like, do you want to go back to Venezuela? Like, do you have a goal to go back and live there?
Yes.
Okay, so can you close that circle for us?
Absolutely. There's going to be an election on May 20th. And I say election the same way I would say North Korean or Cuban election. You know how they go.
Right.
They are staged, and they are, I think it's not even fair to say that they are cheat elections anymore, because they just, like, run by a single party state, and then, you know, like, they can do whatever they want with it. They don't have to independently verify anything, and not even the UN signed up for observation mission this time. Like, no one actually believes in this election.
The opposition is the Democratic Unity Coalition, right?
Uh-huh.
And they're boycotting it.
They're boycotting it. I'm not sure politically that's the best idea. Maybe it would be good to kind of try to participate in some way.
And prove
that it is a sham.
Yeah.
But they feel, and this is not my position, but I think that their position is very clear that they think that by only participating in it, they're validating that the election can be real. And
right.
And that's why they chose to boycott it.
Right, okay.
So I don't anticipate things changing dramatically in Venezuela after the election. It might happen, but
Do you get a vote?
Well, no, because I'm outside. And I have to, like, so if you're Venezuelan, you're assigned to a voting center that you go to. So like in my case, it's my hometown of Valencia. I would have to go back there and vote. And I could go and vote if I really wanted to. Then I have a series of problems there because I need to renew my passport. My passport expired recently, and I have a Spanish passport too because my grandparents are Spanish. So that's what I use to move around the world because my other passport is expired. And there's currently no passports issued in Venezuela right now. So if I were to go back to Venezuela to leave the country, I need and you need to leave on your Venezuelan passport. They don't allow you to leave on other passports. So wow. I would need to renew it, and I would need to buy a passport on the black market. And that costs like $4,000 or something like that.
Jeez.
So I obviously don't want to give $4,000 to the Venezuelan establishment. So I'm not going.
So the Venezuelan establishment is running the black market.
Of passports? Absolutely. Okay. They control the passport issuing. So.
Okay, so there's an election. You're not going to vote.
No.
And it's essentially going to be a worthless sham election.
Yes, it's going to be a ceremony to give Maduro another crown for another 6 years.
So what will finally force change?
Money. I think...
The lack of money?
Lack of money, yes, right. Absolutely.
A complete and utter collapse.
Yes, because... As I said, the government has a cost. Like they are running on fumes right now,
mm-hmm.
and they have a lot of expenses because they have to pay. They have to buy out virtually. You know, they have been good at downsizing the government they have to pay less money to less like to fewer people. But there has to be a time when that stops working
mm-hmm.
because you need. I don't know how many people. Maybe you need 100. Let's say you need 100. Like you could run the Venezuelan state on only 100 people. What happens when you have less money than what you need to pay those 100 people? That maybe some of them might be in the military, some of them might be in the executive, some of them might be
you know,
lobbying for China and Russia and whatever. What happens if you know you just can't pay them anymore? You kind of have to run out. The thing is that they've been really skilled at this game where they kick the can down the road and do it over and over again because they have a lot to lose.
Mm-hmm.
If they leave government any day, they will have to face charges on
corruption,
crimes against humanity, corruption, lots of things that, of course, they just don't want to admit to, and they would very much like to sweep it under the rug.
Okay.
So for them, the cost is huge, and that's why they're doing everything in their power to stay. Okay. So I don't have. I wish I had a prediction to like how much longer it's going to take. I think it's just going to take as much as money allows. And since the Petro was such a disaster, I think that's a very good signal that. They are running on fumes, and they are just like they're out of options right now.
Right, and you would like to go and live back in Venezuela? Right?
Absolutely, yes. I would like to go back and rebuild it, and you know, be a force for change, for like new, you know, economic reality, like new, you know, working in the Bitcoin and crypto space. I would like to infuse some energy there, like to maybe. If we can become like, because if things break down enough, I think we can become the first state or territory where cryptocurrencies, like there's no like official currency anymore, and cryptocurrencies are the law of the land. And Yeah, that would be very exciting.
I think it'd be amazing. I think the main, I think the issue I've always had with that is this instability. It has to peg to something.
Sure.
So you have to peg a crypto to something. So if you peg it to the dollar, there's been, you know, if you peg it to the Bolivar, then obviously it's a great investment, you know, but almost feel like you need some form of like stable coin, but then I'm not a fan of stable coins. So
yeah.
Until we have some stability, I can't see that happening, but I think it would be a great thing.
I mean, the thing is, you don't really have to choose. When you have money that doesn't work, you can take, like, Bitcoin is preferable to barter. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter that you have dollars like that, that, you know, if you were to make the dollar the national currency of Venezuela, which is like one proposal that's flying around, like economists and so on, Ecuador did it. So,
yeah.
And lots of people, like many countries in Latin America have done it, like at certain points in their history, to like try to peg their currency to the dollar or to just outright instill. And it has
relatively.
Worked relatively. Yeah, it has brought more fiscal the responsibility for sure, like because they cannot print dollars.
Yeah,
so it is in a way a,
like, you can't print Bitcoin.
Exactly. So that's my point. If you have a currency that absolutely doesn't work, you might as well try to use a cryptocurrency that you don't control to you know, to have economic activity.
Yeah.
And I think it would be way more interesting to be the first country that uses Bitcoin on a massive scale than to be the upteenth country that will try to use the dollar again,
because that's
been done.
Yeah.
We have done it, and maybe it works better than Bitcoin, but we won't know until we try.
Okay, man. Listen, we've done an hour and a half there.
Okay.
Can you just close out by telling people where they can get hold of you, how they can follow you, what you're working on, and what the future is for you?
Sure. So my handle on Twitter is ALEGW. ALEGW.
Yeah.
It's easy. And I'm on Twitter a bunch of time. And I'm traveling a lot. I'm working on projects that relate to cryptocurrency in Venezuela. I don't want to advance too much because it's really still a work in progress. But I do want to say that there are opportunities in the space where Bitcoin can help a great deal of Venezuela. So like I could say that I'm working on a crypto airlift, kind of like the, you know, when the Berlin airlift successfully circumvented the Soviets' blockage of West Berlin. I think something similar could be done to that, because the Venezuelan government is clearly not giving up on their strategy of cutting off Venezuelans from provisions and from like a good life. So what would happen if we could, in a way, airdrop Bitcoin or any kind of sound money to Venezuelans at a massive scale and kickstart a local economy that doesn't have to depend on a currency that is constantly devaluating?
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of question I'm pondering right now, and I'm working with other people to do it. It's a very tricky subject. You have a lot of variants there. Like, you know, you have to, like, stop civil attacks from happening, and you have to, that's actually the main thing we're struggling with right now. How do you verify that you are actually dropping the same amount of coin for every citizen, and not, you know, you're not dropping more coin to the government or to some like special power? And that is a very interesting question that I'm pondering, and I'm generally working in usability for crypto. I want crypto to be usable and useful to people everywhere, and that's my mission. That's what I want to accomplish in Venezuela and everywhere. All the projects that I'm working on right now are geared towards that, like having that kind of mass adoption.
Well, then keep me updated.
Absolutely.
Honestly, this was fantastic. There's so much we didn't cover. This is becoming more apparent. Like, thank you.
Thank you.
Can't wait to get this
live. Thank
you,
Peter. It was a pleasure, and we could do this anytime you like.
Okay, look, safe travels, and we'll catch up soon.
Thank you.
What did you make of that? I hope you found it as interesting as I did, doing all the research into the history of South America and socialism there, but also the recent movement to socialist governments in Venezuela with Hugo Chavez and now the Nicolas Maduro governments has been, you know, it's been really interesting. Since the interview was recorded, there has been another election in Venezuela. Nicolas Maduro has been re-elected. What sounds like a farce of another election, which is now being challenged by the opposition party. It's kind of scary, really. I think, you know, when we live in countries, westernized countries, we sometimes are probably a little bit oblivious to how hard life can be in other countries. And the fact that Bitcoin is there helping people and that Bitcoin mining is helping provide a salary or protecting salaries during hyperinflation, I think it's a really cool and really interesting thing and probably something we don't talk about enough in crypto. So, yeah, I found this super interesting. It was really great to meet Alejandro. I would love to meet him again. I would love to talk to him again. There's a whole load of stuff I'll share in the show notes, including a very cool article that was written by Katie Vogue, which kind of looks at a couple of use cases of people based in Venezuela and their experience using Bitcoin. So yeah, I'll share that in the show notes. Please do support the show. Please do leave us a review. Please do get in touch on social media. Please do check out my website. And please do feel free to email me. As I said before, my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And if you get in touch, I will do my best to reply. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you have a great week and look forward to speaking to you all soon.